We're continuing in the book of Hebrews, chapter 5. Before we are done this morning, I mean, our initial point in just a moment, we're going to read all of chapter 5. Last week, where our focus was really on the first four verses and taking a look at the comments made by the writer about the priesthood, the high priesthood, and the beginnings of laying the groundwork for us to understand better who Christ is, his role as a high priest, our high priest. And so we took the time to look through those words as well as some others and bring some background into the functioning of the high priest, what it means to have a high priest, and that role. As we read those first four verses, be mentally taking note. Maybe you've already taken note with a pen and pencil or something like that in your Word. But we're going to read the whole chapter. To remind us of what was in last week, I'm going to ask you very quickly to pick out the points about high priesthood in those first four verses, and then we'll go ahead and pick up our discussion with verse 5. So who's at Hebrews 5 and can read that for us?
For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." As he also says in another place, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. About this we have much to say, and it is hard to explain since you have become dull of hearing. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the basic principles of the oracles of God. You need milk, not solid food. For everyone who lives on milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness since he is a child. But solid food is for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil.
Okay, so really got three sections here. The first one's about the high priesthood in general, followed by Jesus and his role as high priest, some aspects of that, and then this piece here at the end where the author is pointing out that I really should be talking to you about things other than what I'm going to have to talk to you about. And we'll get into that when we get there, maybe, but maybe not today. But let's go back to that first section that's really a review of last week. So what things did your eyes pick out from that section about high priesthood in general and the function of it?
Selected among men, but called by God.
Comes from among men, but called by God.
Which means they are beset with human weaknesses and able to, I like how this says this, what is it? Deal gently with the ignorant.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things in what Tiffany said. One is these high priests have their own issues. And with regard to the ones that came out of the Aaronic priesthood, those issues included their own sin. And so they had to deal with that on the way to getting ready to help deal with our sin. I shouldn't maybe say our sin because we don't have a Aaronic high priest dealing with our sin. But with the sins of those Jewish people that they were taking in front of God to have those sins reconciled and to make peace with God for that sin. And so they were able then to functionally also deal with those people who were, what was the words in the New American Standard? Ignorant and misguided. Wouldn't you like to be part of that congregation? Okay, we're the high priest and we're here to help you, the ignorant and the misguided. But anyway, accurate. I mean, we can find, if we want to find even harsher words about who we are, we can find those very easily. Dead in our trespasses and sin, far off, you know, God didn't choose the great and the mighty, but chose the weak and the feeble to glorify himself. So we're never held up as anything special, regardless of what words you might pick. So, but anyway, so here's this high priestly role that makes, what part of what equips them is their own weaknesses, and then they're able to deal with those around them. What else?
He's a mediator between us and
God. Mediator between God and men, worked both ways. They were dealing with those misguided people, but then they also represented those misguided people in the Holy of Holies with regard to, as one example, with regard to the sin offering and the sacrifices. Okay, what else?
They offer gifts and sacrifices.
They offer the gifts and sacrifices. They were the path by which those gifts and sacrifices were taken to God. Okay? What else?
This passage, they were Aaron's.
Right. They were the household of Aaron, and they were chosen by God just as Aaron was. So that would also be true in terms of the Jewish high priest. There's one thing in there that we've kind of said, but I want to say it in the way that the word says it here. It wasn't an honor that they went after for themselves. In other words, you didn't, as a young child, you might think it would be cool. But the way to the high priesthood was not through some political means or some way in which you earned it or could somehow acquire it for yourself. It wasn't by their power that they became high priests. It was by the very calling of God. So it wasn't something that you went on to honor yourself with. Let's see, what have we skipped? I think we did a pretty good job. Probably one thing that we ought to emphasize is that they're appointed on behalf of men by God, that isn't said right there, but later here in verse 1, in the things pertaining to God. So their function in life was to deal with the things pertaining to God. I think other than that, we pretty much have everything that I had in my short list. So with that in mind about what the high priest is, let's go ahead and pick up in verse 5. So now what's going to happen here is we're going to see how God established Christ as a high priest. So what do we see first of all in verse 5? What's the point of that verse? How does that fit in with the logic and the flow of what the writer's saying? And what does it mean by it?
The priest didn't choose. Mm-hmm. He was called. Jesus didn't choose. He was sent. He was called.
Okay, he was chosen. He was sent. And before we're done, down through the rest of these verses, we're going to see even more about that, how that's emphasized by who the chooser is and how he was sent and even how he's different than the Aaronic priesthood. So, but what's his point? I mean, he was chosen, he was sent. What's the implication of that? Is it compared to those verses we just looked at in the first four? What I'm looking for is pretty subtle here, so my ability to ask it in question form might not be there. So let me just say it. Jesus is a legitimate high priest. He starts out, he's going to go through and show us the legitimacy of Christ as a high priest. I mean, it's a competitive thing, isn't it? It was competitive when Christ was here on earth. When we studied through the book of John, Christ was always butting heads with the Jewish leaders. And their fallback was always, we're children of Abraham, we are the high priest, you know, we're the ones that were given God's word, we're the chosen people, all those things about their special place. And Jesus is coming here saying, well, if you knew the Father you claim to represent, you'd know me, because he sent me. I mean, that's the constant battle that's going on, to the point that the high priests and the Jewish leaders all conspire together to do just exactly what God wanted, which was to put Christ on the cross. But their hearts weren't to do it because that's what God wanted. They were doing it because that's what they wanted, to put this guy out of the way that they not only were frustrated with his coming in and taking away from their role, but also they saw him as an imposter, a fake, an upstart. So that's still going on at the time this is written. You still have the Jews over there. This person of Christ is still viewed as, his legitimacy is questioned as being a religious leader, of having a place that would align itself with God the Father. So Christ didn't glorify himself. He didn't take it on for himself so as to become a high priest, and it was appointed to him by God. And here are some of the words that the author points back to bring this up. First of all, he said to him there in verse 6, no, I'm still in verse 5, "You are my son, today I've begotten you." Now that's an interesting place for him to start in order to say Jesus didn't take this on for himself. You know, this point's going to be before he's done, Jesus is a legitimate high priest. As a matter of fact, before we get done with the subsequent chapters, he's not just a legitimate high priest, and he even starts to hint at it in this chapter, but he is a far superior high priest. And so, you know, you're thinking, well, he's headed toward Jesus' role as high priest, but that isn't where he starts. He first starts and says, what? What are these words? What does it mean?
Son.
He's the very Son of God. So it's almost like he goes beyond the priesthood and says, if you're going to question Christ, let's start here. He was God's own son. So is he going to be considered an adversary to God? Is he going to be contrary to the priesthood that God would establish? Well, absolutely not. Where does that come from? Let's go over to Psalm 2 and just read that. Yeah. Let's just go over to Psalm 2 and read that. Not a very long psalm. I really like it. I think it's a cool psalm. Fits right in with what we're talking about. Because what we're going to see here is the same kind of a conflict that I was talking about a moment ago between the Jewish leaders and Jesus and his followers, but primarily with Christ himself. He didn't have very many followers following when he went to the cross. And this is a little different because it's nations and the power of God. But let's read, and God's role in their world. Let's read Psalm 2. Anybody that's got it, go ahead.
Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have exalted my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. Now therefore, O kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son, that he not become angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath may soon be kindled. Not blessed are all who take refuge in him.
So let me put you in a challenging spot. Let's go back to the era that the Psalms were used. They were originally put together, the people were using them as on a daily basis or as a part of their lives. What era would that be? When would we be talking about?
In the temple.
What's that?
In the temple.
In the temple worship. Various psalms get used various ways, but absolutely, in the time that the temple was existing, it was a part of temple worship. A portion of them, we know who was king when they were written, because he's given credit. Who's the king?
David.
So let's go back and try. This will be difficult. It's difficult for me. I don't get clear there. But let's go back and try to think about how these words would have read and felt and been heard, what their meanings would have been if you were in that era. And when we look at that, it starts out with, why are the nations in an uproar? What nations are we talking about?
Canaanite
the nations surrounding Israel in some fashion. This is a, I don't know that we can always depend on, I know that we can't always depend on the chronology of the book of Psalms being chronologically aligned with the timing of things in the nation of Israel. But it's a pretty early psalm. If it happened to be pretty early in the life of Israel, their foothold is fairly strong but tenuous. People are still going after them. They are having good success, and they will have until after the time of Solomon and holding on to their territory and their national identity. But why are the nations in uproar? For people devising a vain thing. The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. So who's his anointed here? Yeah, we can probably be a little more specific than that. Well, maybe. I don't know which king for sure. But certainly that was part of becoming the king. You were anointed king by the prophet. You know, that we saw that happen with Saul. You see that happen later with David. And then it starts to become more hereditary. But early on, they were anointing the king. So they're taking their stand against this anointed. Let us tear their fetters apart, cast away their cords from us. Not very happy with what God is doing in the midst of their nations, are they? They're seeing this as restrictive. I mean, you could even go so far as to say that many of those people were displaced out of the land of Israel. You know, that one time they had exerted the influence over that area, and now here are this people who weren't there, came in from the outside, defeated the Canaanites, scattered the ones that were left, killed many, made a couple of alliances that they shouldn't have made, which left some non-Jewish people in the land, which was against what God told them to do. That created problems for them. So here's this conflict between the king that God anointed, his direction, and what he was doing in the nation. And the writers of Psalms is saying, this is their attitude. We want to get this restrictive God out of the way that's put this mess in our place. And so, he who sits in the heavens, that's who? In four. He who sits in the heavens. I think I'm in the easy question, Jim. Okay, that's God. Yeah, that's one of those Sunday school answers that'll work. What does he do? He laughs. Yeah, yet do we have in the history of world, of nations, of men, of any earthly power, anyone yet to cause anything out of God that would be consternation or fear. God's reaction is he laughs. He scoffs at them. It's effectively not here, but it's who do you think you are? Then, after the scoffing and the laughter, what's he going to do? Speak to them in anger. Okay, guys, I've had it with you. He will terrify them in his fury. And then he will go on and say, but it's for me. I've installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. Where is the holy mountain? Jerusalem. Yeah, that's Jerusalem sits on the top of the mountain, or at least in that area. And so he's installed him there upon Zion. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord, he said to me. You are my son, today I've begotten you. Who's the me? What's that?
Yahweh.
Well, yes, but when he says you are my son, who's the son? It's probably the reigning king.
David, Solomon.
I'm going to guess this is about David, but I don't know that to be true. Ask of me and I will give you the nations as your inheritance, the very ends of the earth as your possession. Pretty strong position to be in and to be taking as an earthly king. You shall break them on a rod of iron, you shall shatter them with earthenware. Now therefore, O king, show discernment, pay attention, make good decisions. Take warning, O judges of the earth, worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son that he's not become angry, and you perish in the way, for his wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all who are taking refuge in him. So how many people do you think when they read that would think of Christ? We read it today, and who's it clearly about? It's clearly about Christ. I mean, this is so true of so many things in the scriptures, particularly from the Old Testament. Jesus said, you guys say you know the scriptures. You must not, because they talk of me. And this is certainly one where they absolutely talk about Christ. I mean, to force fit this, to be talking about some Jewish king, for us is even difficult, isn't it? I mean, it's just so obvious that when God does the things that he's talking about here, when he talks about the Son, he's not really pointing to a king. And maybe they read it that way to an extent, but until the time of Christ, they couldn't begin to have these words truly open up for them. So the verse that we're focusing on, that the writer of Hebrews took us back to, is the last half of verse 7, isn't it? He said to me, you are my son, today I've begotten you. So we don't know how the people exactly might have been thinking about this passage and from the Psalms as the original listeners, as the original recipients of the book of Hebrews. But clearly the writer, when he does this, if they've got some remnant of a feeling about Jewish greatness, of about nationalism for as a Jew, if they've got some feeling of greatness about an earthly kingdom that maybe they feel like they missed because the Messiah that they were expecting didn't do that for them, he makes it very clear about Christ. These words apply. This is the one they're talking about. And depending upon what other information they had from some of the apostles and so on, certainly over time, as those things come to light, it's going to be very clear that a lot of what's being talked about there in that second psalm is going to be done in the times after the age we're living in now. I mean, Jesus is going to rule this world. He is going to crush the enemies. He is going to establish a righteous kingdom. That Messiah they were looking for is indeed coming. It's in the person of Christ, and that's almost where he's pointing, but he's laying the foundation for that. Here's God saying, you are my son, today I've begotten you. And then he brings another passage in verse 6. And in another passage, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. We've got to go look at that. That's in Psalm 110. Got to go look at that one. Psalm 110. Now, I will forewarn you, today is not the day we're going to go significantly into this idea of the order of Melchizedek. Because the writer of Hebrews is going to go into that in great detail for us a little bit later. We'll touch on it a little here, and then we'll really get after it when the writer of Hebrews does as well. But Psalm 110, and then verse 4. What did I do wrong? Oh, turn to 110, that'll work better. Verse 4. You know, let's back up to about verse... let's read 3 through 5. I mean, we're just picking out pieces here, but let's do that. In the middle of this is verse 4. Who can start us out, verse 3, and read through 5?
The people will volunteer freely in the day of thy power, in the holy array from the womb of the dawn. Thy youth are to thee as the dew. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. Thou art a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at thy right hand. He will shatter kings in the day of his wrath.
Okay, and then it goes on to talk about his judgment and all the things. We're talking about establishing that messianic kingdom that Jesus is going to reign over there. But who's writing this? You can sneak back. This is the one book in the Bible where the headings are inspired. We got them from the Jews. David is writing this. And the Lord gives dominion to the king. Now that's not an inspired one. But it's a Psalm of David, and so David here is writing. And one of the things we don't often think about with regard to David is his role as a prophet. But with regard to his writing in the Psalms, David provides a lot of prophetic information in the songs that the Lord had him write. And in this case, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. So you all have probably been exposed to this enough, and we'll do more later, as I said, but what's the significance of being according to the order of Melchizedek? What are some high point things that we ought to be saying just to recognize why that's significant?
Both king and the high priest.
He was both king and a high priest. Yeah, some of you have been through, you've already done the chapters to come, so you're sitting there holding on to this. But yes, he was both king. What was he king of?
Salem.
Okay, good points. So he's both king and high priest, which is a little bit different than what we see in after the Exodus. When that high priest is established, there's a very clear dividing line between king and high priest. Last time we even talked about some of the kings that tried to go the other way. And there was some rebellion among some priestly folks there during the Exodus where they wanted to kind of usurp some of the powers. Or, well, they didn't have a king then, but they wanted some political power, and God took care of that in a pretty devastating way, if you recall. So what else about Melchizedek?
Before the Levitical line.
Before the Levitical line. And I think we'll just kind of let the rest of the things stop there. That's the, both of those are important, but the key one I wanted to get to was this priest, according to the order of Melchizedek, preceded the priesthood that was given to Aaron and his lineage. So this is a preceding priesthood. This is before. And you could even say greater, because we're, what's the story that takes us to our introduction to Melchizedek in the Old Testament? Who?
Abraham.
It's Abraham. Abraham meets up with the with Melchizedek, and Melchizedek functions as God's representative to Abraham in this high priestly role, doesn't he? And how do we see Abraham respond to meeting this meeting Melchizedek in his priestly role? Yeah, worships God, but he also does what?
Tithes.
Tithes and offerings are given to Melchizedek in that high priestly role to be, he's giving them to God through Melchizedek. Melchizedek is his link to God in providing those offerings and sacrifices. Not sacrifices like burnt offerings, sacrifices of his finances. So when Abraham has an opportunity to stop and do some tithing, when he meets Melchizedek, he does it through Melchizedek. So, where can the Aaronic priesthood trace its lineage back to ultimately?
Abraham.
They're children of Abraham. Who did Abraham turn to as a high priest? Melchizedek, which puts these Melchizedek, that puts the order of Melchizedek to be superior to the order of Aaron. We'll get into that in great detail. Maybe not great detail, but more detail later on. So, I've got another question here. So, in the Psalm 110, verse 4, we said, who's writing this? I didn't ask you that question specifically, but you answered it in another way, and that's David. But who does David purport to be quoting? God. So when we look over at Hebrews chapter 5, in both of these cases, these words are attributed to God himself. So God is establishing Jesus as both his begotten son and high priest. That's the groundwork that the author of Hebrews is making here, so that he can establish Jesus. It's the beginning, and he's going to take several chapters of our study to complete it. It's the beginning of him establishing the superiority of Christ in every respect, but certainly in the role of high priest. And so these are foundational, and he will be coming back to them. But he goes on to take care of some of the qualifications of high priest. Verse 7, in the days of his flesh he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. That is a mouthful, because we need to understand what he's saying. So first of all, in the days of his flesh, that is, yeah, that's the time from birth to the cross, right? That's when he was functioning out of a fleshly tent, out of a fleshly existence. And I don't mean fleshly like succumbing to the flesh, but fleshly, he was living with blood and skin and bone and living and walking and functioning in the limitations of, some of the limitations at least, as all men do. And so out of that, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears. Prayers and supplications. Okay, how many of you have prayed in the last month? Okay, no hands went up. I'm going to be talking to you all later. So we ought to know what these words mean. What are prayers and supplications? Put it in your own words. Don't make it fancy. Don't make it. What is it?
Communication with God.
Communication with God. I mean, there's an interaction with God. There's a communion with God, a meeting of the beings. How can that be? I mean, how can you go see God, talk to God? Well, it's obviously born again, whose spirit's living in you. You know, there's an opportunity that gets opened wide open because of the person of Christ. When the veil was rent in the temple, here comes the Holy Spirit available to all men. And being born again includes that link with God, that relationship through the person of Christ as high priest. I'm emphasizing the high priest part, but we all understand what it means that God is available. He hears our voice. And he communes with us in prayer. It's an interaction. Part of it comes from his word. The bulk of it comes from his word. Great time to praise interacting with his word. And supplications. Give me a different word for supplications.
Petitions.
Petitions. That's a good one. Requests. God, this is what's on my mind. I need some help here. This is what's bugging me. This is what I want to be different than it is. God, weigh in on this. You know, you could go through lots of examples when you pray for somebody's salvation, when you pray over some of the devastating things of just living in this life and the problems that come just having to live and to move and go through the suffering that we go through in our physical bodies and all those things. That's going before God. Well, God, here's what's affecting me. Here's what's important to me. Here's where I really want you to be involved. Here's where my heart aches because I think your heart aches. That's the ideal place. Is when our heart is aching over the things that God's heart would ache over, and that's the ideal place to go to him with those supplications, right? So, in the days of his flesh, who's the he here? Jesus, offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death. Loud crying and tears. Well, let's go to a few examples of Jesus praying. I guess I only wrote down the one. I went to some others in my own study. Let's go to one that's poignant. Matthew 26, 36 to 46. It's going to get all of the issues we were just talking about right there together. Maybe it's on the next page. No? That's where I went. Okay. Matthew 26, 36 through 46. Do you ever have this problem that once in a while you got to remember that the scriptures are not in alphabetical order? I find my head going, well, that's M. No, that's not M. Matthew 26, 36 to 46. Going to be familiar to you. Here in a few weeks, it's probably going to be one of the sets of verses we read surrounding the Easter holiday coming up. So let's read this. It's a Garden of Gethsemane. Who can do that for us? Are you there, Tom?
Yes.
Would you read that for us?
Then Jesus went to them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to the disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." How far did you want me to go?
46, if you don't mind.
And taking him, Peter, and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My son, My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nonetheless, not as I will, but as you will. And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Again the second time, he went away and prayed, My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand.
Now, if you need to, keep your finger in there so that if you need to refer back to that, you can say, okay, yeah, that's what happened. But we're going to talk about that passage a little bit in light of what we see over here in chapter 5. So in chapter 5, it said he offered both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears. I mean, this is the most emotion we see out of Jesus in his praying time, to the one able to save him from death. And he was heard, and this version says, because of his piety. So Jesus gave out prayers and supplications to the one who was able to save him from death. Who's he praying to?
God the Father.
God the Father. What's he praying for?
In Gethsemane, you mean?
Well, let's start there. In Gethsemane, what was he praying for?
Well, I think it's clear that he's talking about the cup of wrath that would mm-hmm. be coming from the Father because of the sins of mankind.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Which was going to involve his death on the cross, right?
Right.
And so is it clear that Jesus was saying, Lord, this is not a thing I want to endure.
Not my will, but thine.
But then he goes ahead with the rest of the prayer. And that's the piece we can't miss. And Ted went right to it. His prayer didn't stop there. But nevertheless, if the only way that your will is going to be done here, look at those words. Those words are striking. But Father, if this cannot pass away unless I drink it, your will be done. I think if we look at that and say, if we look at it and think, if he says, well, if the only way is for me to die, then go ahead. I think we'd be stopping a little short of recognizing that I think what Jesus wants to pass away is more than just that cup. If we can't reconcile men with us as God, then let's do it. I mean, the purpose of Christ went far beyond just this moment of this physical death, but the purpose of Christ was to reconcile men to God. And the purpose of Christ took into account this whole issue of men and their helplessness. And so if we can't see the old era pass away, and I'm reading into this and probably in ways that go beyond the words, but clearly Christ wanted the time to change. He wanted the fulfillment of what was to come when he ushered in what we would call the church age, when he ushered in the time that men had direct access from God, that the actual penalty for their sins were paid. And so he wanted that. It's just that the price was clear to him. And so he said, God, this suffering, is there another way? If there's not, then your will be done. And so he followed the will of the Father here and went to the cross. And he made it clear that no one took his life from him. He gave it up. So his will became, through this time of prayer, aligned with the Father. So in Hebrews, it also says, though, and he was heard because of his piety. Let's start out with he was heard. What does that mean? He was praying to the one who could save him from death, God, and he was heard. What does that mean?
Definitely two-way. It wasn't just a one-way communication.
Well, it wasn't a one-way communication. I mean, it's clear from even the prayer that he moves in the prayer. He's hearing while God's interaction isn't recorded for us. It's clear that, you know, he's communing with God the Father in a way that, that he moves from point A to point B in his prayer time. But so God hears it in the sense of took it in. But do you think that's all it means? If you said, God heard my prayers, what are you implying?
An answer.
And probably even, and relieved the issue. You know, he took care of what was going on. How did that happen for Christ? I mean, did God keep him from the cross? No, we know that. So how did God hear his prayers? What was the result?
He did resurrect him.
What's that?
He did resurrect him.
What did you say?
Said verses 8 and 9. It tells us what the result is.
That's exactly right. And although as his son he learned obedience from the things which he suffered, and being made perfect, he became to all those to obey him the source of eternal salvation. But I think you can also add to it what Diane said very clearly. You know, he was resurrected from the dead. I mean, his body was not allowed to suffer decay. He was resurrected. So that's a piece of this. And I'm going to come back to verses 8 and 9 here in just a minute, I think today. But what about his piety? What does that mean? It's not a word we use much anymore. It's not a word we use much. We never did in this in our generations, but you could go back a few.
We talk about his sinless life.
His sinless life?
And his relationship with the Father.
Well, and those certain things certainly would be a part of his piety. I've not kept turning pages with my notes. I've spoken
ahead of him. Well, it speaks of his deity as well.
It does, yes.
Piety is worship rightly directed.
Okay, it is. Those things are all correct. If you go back to this particular word and go back through the languages, this particular one would say in an active way, carrying this out. So all these other things will fit right in with that. But it's godly fear and reverence, including submission. I think that's how I would take the definitions I saw and put them together. It's a godly fear, reverence, and submission. And that isn't that exactly what we saw in Christ in that time of prayer? Godly reverence. Fear. I mean, I think he feared God. He probably had many reasons in a classical way of understanding the word. I don't think he was afraid of God. But he certainly was submissive. Not your will, not my will. Your will be done. This is the plan we started with. This is the plan we're going to finish with. And you are the planner, God the Father. So that word really fits in well in that prayer. And it encompasses, you know, the worship and all those other things as well. We already said that. And we already said that. So I'm not going to go back and do that again. So why would we... I'm going to... probably quit here today with verse 8, but there's an important part of this we've got to get, and he's going to go ahead and really finish it up in 9 and 10, so this is a thought we'll have to carry over to next time. But what's the real value to us in understanding how verses 1 through 4 fit in with where the author's taking us as far as Jesus being high priest, when we get over to this part where it says, in the days of his flesh, he offered up these prayers and supplications and was heard because of his piety. Why would that be important to understand Jesus truly was appointed by God to be a high priest? How does that fit in with verses 1 through 4? Silas, doesn't bother me. Take your time. You can get there.
Sacrifices for others and of himself.
Sacrifices for others and of himself. Okay.
He was human. He had to be human in order to become that ultimate sacrifice for us.
In what we're looking at here in these verses is the author is emphasizing the absolute humanness of Christ. I mean, if you were to just take a step back and describe for somebody what the Trinity is, okay? Well, it's God in three persons, yet separate, distinct, somewhat differing roles, but yet all three together make up God, and yet do you have these individual characteristics for these parts? Hard to explain, but say, okay, I've got the Trinity. So you've explained that to somebody and say, oh, by the way, one member of the Trinity goes to earth and sacrifices themselves to pay the sin debt. Okay, all right, got that. What this does is go beyond that and point out that this act of Jesus coming and living in flesh and blood as a part of the Trinity, you would think, well, you know, he's part of the Trinity. He knows the plan. He could just come in, make his announcements, do his things, give the teaching, so you all need to understand what I'm doing here, go to the cross, die, and move on. And we could talk about, well, he had to live it out as a flesh, or it wouldn't be an accurate sacrifice, and that's all true. But setting that aside for the moment, what this points out is, this Jesus is equipped to operate as our high priest because of his humanness. It goes back to that phrase there in verse 2, he can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself is also beset with weakness. Jesus wasn't beset with weakness in the way that we would say these men were, because their weaknesses included sin. And we'll get into that next time in the obedience part of verse 9. But for today, let's stop here and recognize that Jesus prayed to God just like you do. Maybe I shouldn't say just like you do, because there was a stronger relationship there than you have, I'm sure. And so there's a difference, but there is this similarity. I mean, we ought to be thankful for the prayer on Gethsemane, because it shows us that there wasn't some holy anesthesia involved in Jesus' death on the cross. That the arrangements of the way things happen for people in the flesh, from pain and suffering and anguish and emotion, they weren't taken away for Jesus. He went to the cross with his humanness intact. We can see that from the way he lived. He became fatigued. He went off by himself to pray. He got wore out by the crowds. You can even see in the words that he said at times, he got put out with, are you going to leave too now? You can see the sarcasm that he uses when dealing with the Pharisees. I think it's a divine sarcasm. But nonetheless, it's biting at times. At times it's outright in-your-face confrontation, public. So you see all the emotions that get involved in Jesus' life. You see his strategies. But you also get to see behind the scenes on occasion, for example, when he delayed going to Lazarus, that he knew the purpose and was just set upon doing things so that when it was all said and done, God would be glorified. And so when we look at all this, though, what we're getting a glimpse into, and we're going to carry on next week with it, is that this high priest is extremely unique. He not only came and lived a sinless life, and we'll talk about that next time, and died on the cross and accurately paid the sins, but in his role as high priest, he also knows what it's like to live in the flesh. And it makes him qualified to truly be a mediator between God and men. And if you go look at that verse in 2 Timothy 2:15, I think I got that right. Well, there's one mediator between God and men. And I like the way Paul says it here. The man, Jesus Christ. So, next time, we will pick up verses 9 and 10. Lord, you're kind. Oh, kind enough to come and to live in our midst as a human, as a man with flesh and blood and everything that went with that. And what a difference that makes when we think of you representing us before God And what a difference it makes to know that you, in the flesh, came, lived sinlessly, and conquered sin and death, and was resurrected from the dead, that we might have that same hope. Lord, continue to press into our minds what it means to know that we have a high priest. And not just a high priest, but a high priest as qualified as you are. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.